Muddy Knees Media.
Today, football's greatest ever hometown hero, a man with brains in his feet, eyes in the back of his head, and a chip that could kill from 11 metres. A man who conquered the world and yet never left home. From the Cook Isle to the Goodbyes, from the Quattro Papini to the no love for the Cugini, signore e signori, Francesco Totti.
La Roma che conosco la porto sempre dentro, nei giorni di burrasca e in quelli senza vento. Tra vicoli, palazzi, bar, trattorie, so 100.000 strade e sono tutte mie.
E sono tutte mie le facce della gente, le nonne sul balcone, il ricco, il mendicante, posteggiatori, tassinari, barbieri e benzinai. La Roma che conosco non la conosci mai.
Francesco Totti there, listener, with his eulogy to the eternal city, La Roma che conosco. James Horncastle, tell us more about what we just heard.
Non la conosci mai.
Yeah.
The Rome that I know, you'll never know, or what you don't know about it. And yeah, this was a track that Totti guested on, along with the other Romans, his teammates at the time, Alberto Aquilani, De Rossi, I think Gianluca Curci as well. There's a local musician called Marco Conidi who's trying to steal the crown from Antonello.
Ha! As if.
Yeah.
Not going to happen.
To allow De Rossi in, given he's from Ostia.
Well, yeah, come on. Ostia is Rome's sea, Gab. You know that.
Gabriele Marcosi also here with us. And we kick off with that, Gab, because I don't think there's a player anywhere who is as representative of his city. It's so fundamental to Totti and the phenomenon of Totti, his whole Romanità.
Yeah, very much so. Do you remember that Star Trek spin-off, the one with Captain Janeway and the Doctor, who was actually like a hologram? And so he was there and he was a very good doctor when he was on the holodeck or in the medical bay or whatever the hell it was, but like he couldn't actually go anywhere because then he just disappeared because he wasn't real. I think that's a little bit Totti. Like, he's so intrinsically tied with Rome that you can't fathom, I'm sure we'll get to this maybe in part two, his existence anywhere else, except for sort of very brief periods of time. And I don't think he can fathom it. I know it seems like a stereotype, but this is a guy who's never even tried. I mean, Daniele De Rossi moved to Boca Juniors. I know he came back, but, you know, Daniele De Rossi, like, married somebody who's not from Rome. Daniele De Rossi actually speaks English. You know, like, this guy is so focused. And it's interesting because, obviously, if anybody's heard me speak Italian, I'm most definitely not from Rome. But one of the things about
Gaps
Rome,
from Naples.
Yeah, exactly. Very much so. No, but one of the things that they say in Rome is that, you know, there's very few Romani veri because it's a city that people emigrate to. And, like, you know, if you can't trace your lines back sort of 3, 4, 5, 6 generations, and like, I have no idea where, I mean, maybe James knows where Totti's ancestry is from.
Well, he's 7th generation Roman.
7 generations is what they say, right? Now, to me, because the city is so engulfing and, you know, it's such a sink or swim environment, I mean, I know Nigerians who move there at the age of 12 and they're 1,000,000% Roman after just 5 years. I don't know if you were headed down that track or given your colonial past, you were able to approach the city in a different way. But I'm talking about your peeps. To Romans, they can identify the ones who are there, who belong there, and they just have a different...
Oh.
Exactly.
It is funny how Roma is very much caput mundi, but only of its own little world. And that...
Well, and this is what they say in Italy as well, that Roma is very provinciale. It's almost like a village. Certainly the mentality that people seem to have there, rather than being this big, grandiose, majestic capital, which... It's very decadent, as, you know, again, you can see in one of what Sorrentino's films, La Grande Bellezza, which, you know, I think Totti is very kind of, would be appropriate subject to be incorporated into that film.
Well, banks to talk about with Francesco. Was he a deadly forward who could play like the world's greatest midfielder, or was it the other way round?
Was he the greatest Italian player of all time? It's a debate that some people have. Certainly, it's one that Zenik Zeman, you know, whenever he's asked, you know, who is the greatest ever player,
he says top five are Totti, and Totti. Crazy. That's Zenik Zeman. What a kidder he is. We'll also be looking back at our top Totti memories, but we're going to begin at the beginning. Ur pupone, ur bimbo d'oro, born 27th of September 1976 in San Giovanni in the southern part of the city, growing up in Via Vitulonia, 18. Family were Romanisti, and as a kid, Francesco had a poster of Il Principe, Giuseppe Giannini, on the wall, but also one of Roberto Mancini. A diminutive kid who soon begins to make a name for himself in youth football in the capital. I remember in Rome when we were young, says Alessandro Nesta, when Rome, when we were young, Totti was always Totti, even as an eight-year-old.
I mean, there's a great video on YouTube, old footage of I think it's the Lenzini Trophy. And Lenzini was the president of Lazio in the 70s when they won the Scudetto. And Totti is playing for Lodigiani, one of the teams that he did play for before he went to Roma. And he comes up against Alessandro Nesta's Lazio. And I think Totti and his team ends up winning that tournament. But again, there was this feeling that these two players, these two individuals, their destinies were in some ways linked. But unfortunately for Lazio, because of the financial troubles that they had, they were never able to keep their players,
right,
their Romans, like Marco Di Vaio, for example, in the way that Roma were. Milan were the team that came in for him first. And it was Ariadne Braida, who was the sporting director for a long, long time,
even before Lodigiani.
So this is before Lodigiani.
He was at Trastevere, I think.
Yeah, and he turns up at the Totti's door on Via Vitellonia and basically says, "We'll look after your boy. These are all the things that we can do. You know, we can set you up with work up in Milan. We've got schools for him. Come along." You know, this was 2 years, I think, into the Berlusconi era, and they were saying, "Look what we've done to Paolo Maldini. Paolo Maldini's come through," and they said it's too early for him to move. And Totti, as we see, even though he releases all these joke books, he doesn't seem really ill at ease on the big stage, be it on TV or be it on the football pitch. He's actually a very timid character, and certainly at that stage in his as a boy, he didn't want to leave Rome. And he never wanted to leave Rome.
Right, he was pretty small as well as a kid, and maybe that was part of the reason that he was still at Lodigiani at age 12 when the deal is done with Roma for him to join their youth ranks. Do you know who gave him his first professional deal at Roma?
Was it Giannini's dad?
No, it was Luciano Moggi. So 89, age 12, he joins the Giallorossi, and it doesn't take long before he gets his first team debut. Age 16, on the 28th of March, 1993.
Yeah, and he's playing for, I can't remember which age group it was. I think it was not the Primavera, but maybe just slightly before that. And he is playing against Ascoli. He scores twice, gets to halftime. He goes to the dressing room, and a director from Roma comes in and basically says, "Get a shower. You're not going out for the second half. You're coming with us." And he gets on the bus with the first team. So all these guys that he's kind of grown up idolising, not just Giannini, who, I mean, I think we've maybe said in other podcasts how important this legacy of Roman captains, not just Giannini, but Di Bartolomei. And he is idolising, but he also idolises Thomas Hasler.
Yeah, Tomasino Hasler.
Hasler, who, it's his injury, actually, in their final training session before leaving for Brescia that allows Totti to basically get a place in the first team squad. And, yeah, they fly there, and all of a sudden, he says it's the first time he's left Rome aside from going to the beach.
Which
outside.
He only went like half an hour down the road anyway.
Yeah. And he's staying in a hotel with all these guys. Giannini basically takes him under his wing because Giannini's father, a little bit like De Rossi's father, who's involved in the youth sector, knows Totti, has spoken to his son about him, says this kid's got a lot of talent. And then he's sat on the bench during this game. And after 83 minutes, I think Boskov turns and says...
Well, it's Mihalovic, apparently, who says... Sinisa Mihalovic, who was at Roma at the time, and I think Ruggero Rizzitelli, Rizzi goes coming off. Mm. And Mihailovic says, send the kid on, Vujicic, Boskov. Boskov, who, I mean, the popular conception is, was kind of there but also not there and was happy to do whatever. And went, yeah, sure, why not?
Boskov apparently turns around and basically says, right, get stripped off, get ready. And Totti doesn't think he's talking to him. He thinks he's talking to Mutsi next to him.
Mutsi.
And then Mutsi looks at him and says, go on, get a move on. And he comes on, makes his debut.
He was 16 years of age, 16. Carlo Mazzoni, though, was the next man in charge, and the man who actually gave him his first start. This is the start of the 94-95 season. By now, Francesco is a venerable 17 years of age. And Mazzoni makes the surprising choice for the first game of the season against Foggia to leave Abel Balbo on the bench and play Francesco Totti up front with Daniele Fonseca.
Yeah, it's because they could only play three foreigners at the time, and they had four. Balbo, Fonseca, Jonas Tern, and I imagine Aldair or
probably
Pluto.
But the young Francesco scores.
In area per Fonseca, che paratore per Totti. Sinistro in corsa e palla nel sacco. Molto bravo il giovane attaccante romano schierato alla posto di Balbo.
The following month, and this is the first time he really kind of burned his way into my consciousness, he gets a run out against a slightly bigger opponent, Barcelona, the dream team. Stoichkov, Koeman and the rest.
Ha guanyat un poder de la pelota, atenció, al gol que acaba d'abarcar Totti. Al gol espectacular que acaba d'abarcar Totti.
Totti there, hovering on the edge of the box, leaping up and performing a wonderful sort of semi-rovesciata, a bicycle kick, and from about 20 yards out, very, very impressive. There'd been a lot of talk of this young promessa. But I think with that, we began to realise that it was for real.
Yeah, and shortly after making his debut, scoring goals like that, James, he's still living with his parents, of course. And you know, there's already this kind of great enthusiasm, great sort of, this guy's the next big thing. And just Roma fans keep turning up on the street and they keep taking anything that they think could be touched by Totti. So apparently they even steal like his neighbour's doormats and that sort of thing. And it's at that stage where he's like, geez, I've got... got to get out of here.
There's so they move.
Well, there was also like a mechanics downstairs, and apparently what he used to do when he got his first check and he bought himself a Mercedes, he would basically get these clapped out cars from the mechanic, like banged up Volkswagen Golfs or, you know, sort of Cinquecento kind of cut and shoves, and then just sort of drive around because no one would kind of expect that you'd find Totti in a car that bad.
When it comes to young players, although James and I are cheerleading the fact that it's changing, the reality is in Italy, it's, you know, we're the magical country where you're young until you're 40, sometimes after that.
You live with your mom until you're 50.
And so we have this obsession about, this idea of bruciare I giovani, right? Burn out the youngsters, which is why so few youngsters in Italy, even ones who go, I mean, I think Buffon and Maldini are just the two obvious exceptions, but the vast majority of even very successful players, even Chiellini and Bonucci, you know, these guys, they either play very little or they play for some very small clubs, you know, until they're like 21, 22, 23. And what struck you about Totti, and A, that happened to him at Roma with Mazzone, because in those 3 years, 2.5 or 3 years that Mazzone was there, which is kind of, he sort of became Totti, he didn't play as often. He was kind of in and out. He'd start a game, he'd come off the bench. But what struck you was that he never had any qualms about trying something difficult. You know, in Italy, one of the worst things you can tell a young player is this what we say, fare il fenomeno, right? Go and attempt something really difficult, a back heel, a bicycle kick, and then you don't pull it off, you look like an idiot. That's like the worst crime you can commit, right? It was a weird thing. We want everybody to play within themselves until they become old, and then they have the license to go and attempt things that they can no longer do. But with Totti, that never happened. Totti often tried really difficult, low percentage things like that overhead kick that we just went through. And I think that was another thing that stood out and really helped burnish his image as something, wow. Campionato di
calcio italiano. You're listening to Galazzo, the totally Italian football show.
Teenage Totti now making a real name for himself. And here's an early TV appearance where the host asks him about his future. And Francesco's reply is simple.
Speriamo, ecco. Di continuare a fare il più gol possibile e rimanere sempre a Roma.
Score as much as possible and remain always at Roma. Funny thing was, the very next season, 96-97, Mazzoni's gone and Carlos Bianchi.
Carlos B.
Larry David.
Larry David is in. And he's the first of a series of managers who maybe don't get Totti. So much so that there's this strong move to sell Roma's young phenomenon to Sampdoria, which would have been an extraordinary thing, of him linking up with Roberto Mancini, who was very much ruling the roost there. Yeah. That would have been incredible. Apparently, the Bianchi was for it, and it was only when Franco Sensi, the legendary Roma owner, saw Francesco playing in a one of those weird kind of 45-minute per game triangulars that the clubs used to do. It was with Mönchengladbach and Ajax, and Totti scores against both, and he goes, no, the kid stays here.
The story goes that Carlos Bianchi did not like the Roman players on the team. There was this feeling that Carlo Mazzoni was too indulgent of them because he was from the city. And what Bianchi did, which wasn't popular within the team, was that he would play the Italians against the rest of the world in these little partitelle that they had in training. And it was only, I think, Totti wasn't called up for the under-21s one international break because I think there was a change of manager. I think Cesare Maldini had moved on. So he's still around and he plays in this three-team tournament. And the player that Bianchi wanted to replace him, and they were going to use their money from the Totti deal to buy, was Jari Litmanen. And Litmanen was playing for the Ajax side, and it felt very much that Roma-Ajax game was almost a playoff between Totti and Litmanen as to who was going to be the future of Roma. And Totti ends up stealing the show.
You know, Jari Litmanen, Ajax had been in, two consecutive
Champions League
finals. They'd won one, they'd lost another one, slightly dubious circumstances on penalties. I forget who that was against, funnily enough.
Well, the strength.
No, I'm joking.
The strength of that team.
But, you know, it was this incredible group of very, very talented players, and Litmanen was sort of the brains of the operation. And Carlos Bianchi, this was explained to me by, because, you know, this is the Bianchi version, was he's like, we have these younger players here, including not just Totti, but some of the guys he'd seen in the Primavera. They're never going to be like the guys at Ajax because they have Louis van Gaal and he can kind of run things the way he wants. He has power. I don't have power. I'm a hired gun here. So the way I do that is, it's kind of like, who was it who went up the mountain because God told him to and he was going to kill
his...
Was it Moses went up the mountain?
Yeah, with the Ten Commandments.
Yeah, he went up the mountain because God wanted him to kill his child and then...
Oh, no, that was Abraham.
Abraham, there you go. It's a bit like that.
Sammy.
Yeah, so if I get them to sacrifice the golden child,
right,
then they will
mine.
Then it will be mine. I will now have their loyalty. I have Litmanen in. They will be invested in me, and then I will have the necessary power. It was a very calculating, tactical thing.
Right.
But fortunately, that kind Mr. Sensi and little Rossella, who I'm sure she was around even back then, since she never ages.
Yep.
They foil the dastardly plan.
Totti wins that particular duel with Litmanen and with his manager as well. Bianchi's gone within a couple of months, and the man who takes over brings better times, because it is Zdeněk Zeman, his first stint with the Giallorossi, legendary Bohemian manager Zdeněk Zeman.
Just sacked by Lazio.
Yeah. It was a genius move by Roma to hire the man who their neighbours and bitter rivals had decided wasn't good enough for them. And a magical period, not wildly successful in terms of, well, actually winning things, but a wonderful period.
Certainly
to be watching.
Not derbies. They lost every one of them. No, but the thing with Zeman, I think when they made this decision, it was who is a coach who will get the most out of someone like Francesco Totti.
And this is the first great period of Francesco's career at Roma. He's consistently the starter. He's now the heart of the team.
Well, and also because Zeman calls him Stella all the time. He's my little star. Puts him on the left side. So he's kind of away from the traffic that you get in the middle. He's certainly skillful enough to deal with that. And he starts scoring goals, starts playing regularly. Not scoring as many as we'd later see in his career, but certainly affecting games. And I think with Zeman, there are two things. There was the physical preparation, which was militaristic, I would say. And you know, they would do these things where they would run 1,000 meter 10 times with very little rest time in between. And Totti kind of credits that physical preparation with the long-lasting career that he would have into his 40s, laying the kind of groundwork that was there, along with his good mate Vito Scala. And also they would do 2 hours a day of attacking exercises, which, you know, I think they didn't do any defensive exercises, and knowing what Zeman was like, because more often than not, this team would finish top of the league in terms of goals scored and 10th for goals conceded.
Zeman would point out that that is just a mean thing to say about him, and that at Lazio, like, they had the second best defense twice or something like that. But you're right. I mean, that is a characterization of Zeman. That's why people fall in love with it, because it was such fun attacking football to see. There was always three people in the box, and if you were a skillful player in tight spaces like Totti, you never ran out of options.
And the movement as well that he would teach. I mean, I think it's no coincidence that as we record this, a Zeman alumnus is top of the scoring charts yet again and could be capocannoniere for a fourth time. It's Ciro Immobile.
Now, amidst all of this, there's still a slight sensation about Totti that he's a big fish in a small pond, that he's not quite the real thing, so much so that in 98, Italy's expedition to France for the World Cup, there's no sign of him in the squad for Cesare Maldini.
Hindsight would say, whoa, this is kind of weird, right? Because he's nearly 22 at this stage. He's obviously super talented. But remember, like I said, this is a country of old people. And on top of that, so maybe Totti's not quite mature enough for the big stage. But on top of that, when it came to sort of those number 10 second striker types, obviously the big star was supposed to be Alex Del Piero.
Yeah.
You had Roberto Baggio, another guy who didn't go to that World Cup, despite the fact that he was lighting it up in the Premier League, was Gianfranco Zola. So there was a lot of competition for places in kind of that second striker role. So I didn't want to give him a pass for that. But
so that was under Cesare Maldini. Dino Zoff takes over, and he does pick Francesco for the European Championships in 2000. And this is where Francesco really becomes an international figure.
Segna anche Totti ha rischiato l'impossibile, ha beffato Van der Sar con un
Mose faccio cucaio.
Yeah, one of his most iconic moments, which was in that semi-final against the Netherlands, which one of the greatest nil-nils of all time. And yeah, it goes to a penalty shootout.
So yeah, there are
lots of things happen in this game. This game is worthy of Golazo episode on its own.
Right. Well, they're just briefly, they're in Amsterdam with the host nation, Netherlands. They've been down to 10 men most of the game. They're up against the Netherlands side, featuring the likes of Patrick Kluivert, Dennis Bergkamp, Edwin van der Sar. It reaches penalties. Di Biagio and Pesotto score for Italy. Frank De Boer and Jaap Stam miss theirs. And up next comes Francesco Totti.
And for context, Italy had been knocked out of, the last three World Cups on penalties.
On Rigori, that's true.
This is a big moment that Francesco decides that he's going to chip the goalkeeper. And that goalkeeper is one of the biggest, tallest goalkeepers around. It's Edwin van der Sar.
Yeah, he doesn't only decide he's going to do it. He tells Pirlo, I'm going to go and chip this
And everyone's
guy.
Like, no.
Well, again, I think everybody's who's on that team has stories to tell about it. I mean, the version I heard from Maldini, as I recall, was he's like, you know, he does the Moje vacher cucchiaio. And Maldini's like, ha 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 ha. He's like smart, he's like laughing. And then like he's like in a movie, like my expression changes and say, like, no, this idiot's really gonna go and do it. Why the hell do we call these people up from Roma to the national team? Why the hell is he here? You know. And but that's okay because
He scores, and Italy goes through to the final, where he's man of the match. He helps
sets up what should have been Del Vecchio's winner.
Wonderful backheel, for Pesotto, who then puts it through to Del Vecchio.
And didn't the other one too, right?
The Del Piero chance.
Oh, sorry, it was Del Piero, yeah.
They lose the final, and it's all Del Piero's fault, because I think there's at least two gilt-edged chances that he serves up for ADP.
Yeah, and I think if they win this tournament, there's a strong case for Totti to win the Ballon d'Or that year, because ultimately the guy who does win it is Luis Figo, who'd gone out in the semi-finals. He just moved to Real Madrid as well. And it didn't feel that there was a natural kind of outstanding candidate. And given this is, I think, Totti's best tournament performance, and it was going into what would be the biggest year of his career,
right,
at least in terms of the success that he had always wanted. There's certainly a feeling that he could have got the Ballon d'Or, which I think on the balance of his career he probably deserved. And again, this folds into the narrative about Totti, that had he moved to a Real Madrid when he had the opportunity, had he played regular Champions League football, had he been part of teams that...
Had he also not spat in Christian Poulsen's face?
Well,
I think all that stuff has a bearing. But you're right.
He certainly had the talent to be a Ballon d'Or winner. I don't think that's...
That is beyond question. Yeah. So he'd missed out on that European title, but the following season, the title does arrive.
Quanto se bella Roma, quando è sera, quando la luna si specchia dentro il fontanone.
Rome's official bard there, Antonello Venditti, with O Roma Capoccia. And it's such a particular city, this. A lot of places feel that winning a title in their hometown is harder than anywhere else. You know, one title here is worth 10 somewhere else. But it is true, Capello's spoken about this, that it is an unbelievably hard place to work and get consistent success from your team. Now, going into the 2000-2001 season, circumstances weren't easy for the Giallorossi. Their neighbours, Lazio, had just won the title under Eriksson.
For the first time since 74.
And Roma's hopes of repeating their last title, which was back in 83, how good did they look?
Well, I mean, this was now Capello's second year. Capello, you don't appoint Capello to finish second, or where did they finish in their first year, Gab, under him?
Were they like six?
I think they were six.
Very
yeah.
disappointing. They come back from the Euros, the internationals like Totti and Tomasi, and they go out the Coppa Italia to Atalanta straight away. And awaiting them at the training ground, Trigoria, is such a mob of ultras, really, 4,000. And the players, at that time, the walls of Trigoria weren't all that high. You could get over them, throw things over them, fish,
they
eggs.
Threw fish at the team. They waved mops, secchioni, yeah. and they threw fish at the team.
Apparently, Cafu tried to drive out and then basically couldn't get out and then had to back in. And when he backed in, his car looked very different to when it had when he'd got into it, dented, been kicked to bits. You know
what a team that was. So Cafu was there with Vincent Candela. Walter Samuel had just arrived.
The wall.
Yeah.
You had the Puma, Emerson.
Younger listeners, this was good Emerson. This was like Bayer Leverkusen all over the pitch.
Yeah. Not Middlesbrough Emerson.
Right.
Well, yeah, not just that, not a different guy, but also not the bad Emerson that we saw at the end of his career.
Right.
When he couldn't get around the pitch.
Okay, there was another guy that arrived.
Batigol.
Yes. And I've probably told the story before of how he arrived.
What, the way that the fans tricked...
The way Franco Baldini and Fabio Capello tricked Franco Sensi.
Sorry, yeah, them. Yeah. Yeah, you have, but go on, briefly again.
So basically, they became convinced that Montella needed somebody to light a fire under his rear end for him to score regularly, and that they needed another center forward, and they needed somebody big and strong, and that Del Vecchio couldn't hit the side of a barn. So we need to sign Battistuta, who of course was the god of Florence at the time. Fiorentina obviously wouldn't sell; they wanted stupid money. Sensi was like, the president was like, this is too much even for me, and so Capello and Baldini, they go out to dinner with the editor-in-chief of Corriere dello Sport, which is Rome's sports daily, and they say, like, look.
Better times for Corriere dello Sport.
Yeah. we're gonna sign him, and it's all down to Franco Sensi. And in his recollection, he says, oh, is that really true? He's like, no, just we want you to write that, and then maybe it'll come true. And we're very, very close. So then the next morning, it's like a front page splash in Corriere dello Sport. And all of a sudden there's a murmur around the city. Baldini talks about how he's in the shower and he looks out the window and he can hear like something's different in the air. And he looks out and there's all these people standing by the news agent pointing, and then they start chanting Franco Sensi's name, and the whole thing becomes really weird. And Sensi wakes up and he's like, what the hell? Like, what? Am I doing this? And you know, all these people are beaming. They all love him so much. And he says, all right, let's do it. Then, of course, leaving Roma into a big pile of debt and Jim Pelotti and all the stuff that would happen afterwards. But, you know, it was fun while it lasted. Yeah.
And boy, it was fun. It took them all the way to their third ever title. A wonderful season. You had Montella and Totti and Batigol up front. You had that defence, which was Capello-esque in its stinginess. And with that, it came to the last day of the season. What was actually the last live Italian game on Channel 4, the Roma-Parma game?
I remember watching this and they cut it short, didn't they?
Well, yeah. So 3-1 was the final score.
Mm.
And when the third goal goes in, the Roma fans, the Romanisti, decide time to celebrate. So they race onto. There's a massive pitch invasion.
Yeah. Capello's going crazy, you know, because he's like, get off, yeah. get off.
And remember what had happened. Remember how Juventus had lost the title
the previous year,
mm. right? In those remarkable circumstances, which, by the way, obviously changed the course of history because that cost Ancelotti his job. There was a sense that Moggi was furious and right. Moggi was going to pull out all the stops. There were rumors, there was reporting that Moggi had like put snipers in the crowd to cause a disturbance so that Roma would have, the game would have to be abandoned. There was this incredible people thought Moggi was somehow like the supreme underworld, omnipotent.
Beelzebub.
Exactly. He was Beelzebub.
Right.
Which, you know, some people might say wasn't that far from the truth. But in the heads of Romans, yeah. this was the ultimate paranoia. And as that season went on and they got closer to the finish line, they were waiting for the stumble. They were waiting for the screw job. They were waiting for, you know, Bret Hart in Montreal with Vince McMahon. It was going to be something like that. But obviously...
What reference
that's
is that?
That's a wrestling reference.
That's a professional wrestling reference. Yeah. But then it never happened, and it was so surreal. I mean, I guess Buffon was the goalkeeper.
Yeah,
right?
he was.
Did you notice what Buffon was wearing at the end of the game?
Nothing. It was mutande, probably.
Yeah, well, because somebody ripped off his shirt.
Yeah, everybody. I mean, the place was...
But again, one of the other things playing on Romanisti minds was the fact that you look at that Parma team. It had Diego Fuser, Marco Di Vaio, Matias Almeida, or Laziali. It was going to be the ultimate beffa.
Yeah, absolutely.
And instead, no, it does. And one of the great stories Totti tells about this game is that usually the bus from Trigoria to the Olimpico, it takes a long, long time because, you know, one of the things that's famous about Rome is the traffic jams. In fact, in that song that we had at the top of the show, one of the lines is that, yes, there are traffic jams, but one of the great things about it is that whilst you're stuck in traffic, you get to see something like St. Peter's. But he says that on that day, it took them 20 minutes in the bus to get from Trigoria to the Olimpico. Why? Because the entire city was at the Stadio Olimpico.
My word.
And the gates had been opened early. This is a classic kind of trope of Italian football. The gates are open early. People have been there for 8 hours.
Boiling.
Yeah.
Boiling under that hot Roman sun. And it all pays off. Totti actually opens the scoring. Adesso la palla è per lui. Candelà all'indietro. Totti! Totti per il vantaggio della Roma. Francesco Totti, 19esimo del primo tempo. Francesco Totti per il vantaggio della Roma, 1-0. 3-1 it finishes, and Roma are champions. They have an extraordinary run after this. They are second in 6 of the next 9 seasons. They're just always there or thereabouts, usually behind Inter. First Roberto Mancini's Inter, and then that man's Inter, Jose Mourinho's treble winning Inter. But
and I might point out of the big Italian clubs, they're the only ones who are untouched by Calciopoli. I mean, completely untouched. Obviously, now we know now about the Facchetti and whatever, and, you know, maybe he was just a doddering old man talking to himself or not, but they don't come up, correct me if I'm wrong, even in the minor...
No, I mean, there was a minor thing, I think maybe the season or two before, where there were some Rolexes, wasn't there, too?
Oh, the Francesco Rolexes.
But not
the...
in the Calciopoli team.
No, the Rolexes.
That's still Moggi, you know, it's just... One way or another.
But also, you know, one of the things that Zeman always used to say about him getting the sack was that, you know, he obviously had made those allegations against Juventus and there was pressure put on Franco Sensi to sack him. And then Zeman could not get a job back in Italy for... Or the jobs that he could get were very basically like just like hospital passes where it's going to damage your career.
Right.
So I think he ends up having to go and coach in Turkey at Fenerbahce because that's the only way Moggi would let him.
Well, post this Scudetto for Roma, one job offer does come up for Francesco Totti. And as you mentioned before, it is with Real Madrid, who are at the time European champions. This is 2002. And the story is that they offered him basically a deal that would have made him the highest paid player in the world. As it turns out, the advice of his friends and family, and apparently above all the fact that he'd just started dating Ilari Balazi, means that he decides to decline their move and they end up buying some Brazilian called Ronaldo.
No, we haven't mentioned instead. His T-shirts.
Because that's another thing about Totti, not just his goals, not just his wonderful assists, but also his wonderful trolling.
Yeah. Usually of Lazio, or in Ilari Blasi's case, a kind of a declaration of love.
And one of the great my girlfriend stroke wife is pregnant goal celebrations as well, in which he stuffed the football under his jersey and lay down with his legs spread, and his teammates then proceeded to deliver the bulge. Wonderful. But yeah, the T-shirt. I mean, the previous season, there'd been that 5-1 in the derby against Roma.
Well, he scores one of his iconic goals, the lob. He lobs Angelo Pirozzi from outside the area. Wow. And that's the fifth goal. Montella had scored four. It's the game where Nesta goes
refused
up.
To come out for the second half.
Yeah.
When was Vio Pedigato ancora?
I think that was before, I think.
There's no direct translation into English, but a purga is what you take when you're constipated and need to, you know,
purge.
So it just can be read. It has so many layers to it. Now, I'm assuming since Totti is so many
so
friends.
So I purged you again is the way that people generally translate it, but it's more nuanced than that.
Yeah, it's not purge as in like Stalinist purge.
I've been through you like a dose of salt.
Yeah, something like
I've given you the absolute, I've made you cack yourselves.
Basically, yeah.
Yeah.
This is a big thing because Ilari is still with someone else at this time, but he doesn't really care about that. And he was single at the time. He'd be partying and knew all these people, you know, PRs who basically set up these parties. Gets introduced to Silvia Blasi and basically, yeah, then bombards her with text to basically get Ilari's number.
Ilari was what they call a soubrette, a TV presenter, a showgirl.
Yeah.
And quite a celebrity in her own right. Totti anyway decides, partly for that reason apparently, to stick around in Rome, and actually goes to the Bernabeu a couple of months later in the Champions League and scores the only goal in a famous Roma victory away to Real Madrid. I mean, he says he was very happy with his decision not to move to Real. You touched before on what it might have meant to him in terms of international recognition, though, and he has said that he thinks he would have, I mean, slightly Totti-esque says, yeah, would have won two or three Ballon d'Ors and Lord knows what else.
He would have won a load of league titles.
Right.
That's very likely.
Yeah, and he, I think, one of the last times, if not the last time, that Roma played Real Madrid, I think this was on the Spalletti, second time around, he organises for a load of shirts to come with him to the Bernabeu so he can give them to Sergio Ramos. Sergio Ramos, a big fan of Totti's. And he, I think, signs one for Florentino Perez, basically from the one guy who turned you down.
Of the Totally Scottish Football Show. And if you like football, you're gonna love Scottish football. It's not all just Stevie G and Scott Brown up here. No, because we talk about all of the Scottish football, and geez, oh, it's great. There's actually a title race this year in the Premiership. Stevie G will be hoping not to slip up again. Hearts are tearing each other a new one. Motherwell are doing well. Well, they're doing well. So, if you like your football to be competitive, have a title race and a ton of drama off and on the pitch, the Totally Scottish Football Show is most definitely for you. Grab Scottish football by the balls, just like Ryan Christie did, and listen to the Totally Scottish Football Show, available everywhere, even in England. Campionato
di calcio italiano. You're listening to Galazzo, the Totally Italian Football Show.
After turning down that move to one of the biggest stages a footballer can play on, the following years then see Totti's reputation, rather than growing internationally, actually taking one or two knocks. And the reason was his performances with the Italian national side. 2002, the disastrous World Cup, which ends, of course, Byron Moreno giving Totti a red for diving in the match against South Korea.
Not his fault.
Not his fault, but nobody emerges from that expedition with any credit. 2004, then, even worse, the European Championships in Portugal, where Totti's campaign is ended when he spits
by
in...
Sweden and Denmark.
By Sweden. Yeah. Well, by Totti spitting in Christian Poulsen's face after, you know, he received a certain number of knocks.
We need to put it in context and so that we can give all his excuses here, right? 2004 is also when, you know, Judas Iscariot stroke Benedict Arnold stroke Fabio Capello stroke Pete in the Garden of Gethsemane denying Jesus walks out. All of a sudden, you just walk out.
His lock is empty and he hasn't said goodbye to anyone.
After 3 years of calling Juventus cheats and drugs and this like that and being sort of the leader of the good fight, he kind of rips off the mask and goes and joins Juve. And look, I mean, I exaggerate, but this is how Rome lived the moment, right? Then they appoint Prandelli to be the Roma manager. And then, of course, Prandelli's wife tragically passes.
Or she gets sick.
Or she gets sick, sorry. So he doesn't take the job so he can be with her. Obviously, she would pass later. And he gets thrown into this thing. He's got Trapattoni in his ear, right? And saying like, oh, you're going to carry this team. You know, oh, forget Roma. That doesn't matter. You know, forget it for now. Just focus on Italy, this bigger things. He's got to show up to the Italian national team, see the Juve guys every day, right? And then he has the misfortune of the opening game against Denmark, which finishes 1-1. Italy play reasonably well. It just so happens that Danish television decide, oh, let's do a special analysis on Christian Poulsen's man marking of Francesco Totti. This is kind of like VAR before VAR, right?
Yeah.
They have their own camera there. It's not part of the official
television
cameras for the game. There would even be a debate about whether that evidence would even be admissible. As it happens, you know, this is Christian Poulsen, pretty skeevy,
yeah,
right?
It's not the fact that he got caught though; it's the fact that he did it, which is kind of important.
Yeah. But afterwards, like, it's only when he's shown, because he has no recollection of actually doing it. This is the thing, and maybe that's part of his excuse or whatever. But it's only when Vito Scala, his right hand man, basically comes up and says, "Francesco, there's a video going around of you spitting in Christian Poulsen's face. Did you do that?" And he's like, "What?" And then he sees it, and it's incontrovertible.
But the fact that it's not an official camera, I mean, let me put it this way. I'm not. No, but let's assume this camera is Danish television's camera, right? If that camera also picks up Poulsen making faces at him and picking his nose and throwing boogers at Totti and whatever, they're not going to share that.
Right.
They only share the part. Do you know what I'm saying? It's like the Zapruder film.
I understand what you're saying.
Right?
The fact is, though, that evidence is used to ban.
But look at
Francesco.
The representation he gets for himself. Do you remember this?
Giulia
Bongiorno, who defended Andreotti.
Wow.
Yeah.
In the mafia trials.
Successfully, more successfully.
Ultimately, yeah. It didn't matter because of the stitch-up, because of the fix in the other
biscotto.
Game. Exactly.
Right. Anyway.
And Zlatan Ibrahimovic's weirdo back heel,
yeah,
which, you know, is a one in a million, maybe right. One in 100,000, given it's Zlatan, but still. Yeah.
Anyway, Italy, don't make it out of the group. It's nice that Francesco didn't lose his sense of humour, though. It was around this time, actually, I think it was following the Euros that he published these two joke books, basically riding on the momentum of the fact that he was perceived to be not an especially bright chap and that people were making Totti jokes. And he basically collected them together, or his people collected them together, and he published them as in, have you heard the latest from Totti? And all the proceeds going to charity, and it raised a lot of money. One or two choice examples for you. What were the three hardest school years for Totti? Class 1 in elementary school. Totti tries to finish a jigsaw puzzle. It takes him almost 4 months. He turns the box over. It says, from 2 to 3 years. He says, so I'm a genius.
And these are all the kind of corny jokes.
Yeah.
Like, in a different context, you know, like...
The video.
The video is genius.
Because
the
even if you don't
so
understand
funny.
Italian, the laughing is contagious. Like with Del Piero.
So this was done at, I think, Borgesiana, okay. As far as I can tell. Maybe it was Coverciano, but it was with the Italian national team.
Mm.
And basically they do a TV special where they get Totti and his Italy teammates to enact or recount some of these jokes. Only... they just can't. Del Piero is completely loser. Del Vecchio is the other one where Totti's beginning this joke, which is, do you know my grandfather is dead? And every time he says it, Del Vecchio just dissolves.
Lo sai che mio nonno è morto?
Okay.
Sai che mio nonno...
So, mid-noughties, that's where Totti is. Internationally, maybe not taken as seriously as he is in Italy. In Rome, he's a god. With Roma, Capello's now been replaced by Luciano Spalletti. Totti has got married.
Replaced by about 10 different people, and then Luciano Spalletti.
And then Spalletti, right, yeah. Okay, all right. Totti's got married to Ilari Blasi as a mark
low
of their...
key affair.
Yeah, as a mark of their collective celebrity. The ceremony at the Basilica of Santa Maria is televised live. And it's a full of... I mean,
yeah, so if you go to Rome and you'll see Piazza Venezia with the wedding cake... And then just what, round the back, Campidoglio, and there's the stairs going up to the wedding. It really gives you a kind of sense of how kind of central and how kind of big this event was.
Right.
Which is broadcast live on Sky.
Right. With the proceeds going to charity.
Again.
Yeah. But a kind of Cheryl Cole, Ashley Cole affair. And on the field, something interesting has happened as well. Another kind of chapter in the evolution of Francesco as a player. You talked earlier on about Zeman and his vision of Totti as this wide player. Other people had considered him a more deep-lying midfield supplier. But what happens in this season here, which is 2005-2006, when Spalletti has that run of injuries with Roma?
Blackburn legend Shabani Nonda gets injured. Everyone gets injured to the point that they end up having to play with six midfielders, the 4-6-0.
The 4-6-0. So this was the false nine.
Hmm. I remember when United played Roma that year in the Champions League.
Right.
And obviously they played this system. Roma played actually very well in that first leg. I think it finished 1-1. Ronaldo scores that insane header.
Right.
And then obviously everybody remembers the second leg.
The 7-1.
The 7-1. One of the many 7-1s that we're about to probably get into in Rome's history. But shortly after that, United start playing more or less the same way with Cristiano playing essentially as a false nine, or as a number nine, as many people would say.
But it
catches fire across Europe, James.
It didn't work for them at Old Trafford, but it's insanely successful in Serie A. They go on this winning streak of 11 straight victories under Spalletti.
What made Roma's version different, and when people talk about false nine, you're essentially talking about 4-3-3, and you're talking about a centre forward who drops, and you've got attacking wingers who convert, right? That's kind of the general idea, and then he takes his marker with him and opens up space, and that's fine. That's what Liverpool often do with Firmino, because you've got Salah and Mane. But Roma had Rodrigo Taddei, and was it Mirko Vucinic?
Perotta.
And then what Roma did was they always had somebody breaking from midfield, usually Simone Perotta, sometimes Daniele De Rossi, who was actually quicker back then than people remember. So it was a very different interpretation. It was a lot more sort of schematic movement-based, with the one wild card being Totti, who essentially everybody adjusted. They had like three or four movements, but they were always adjusting to whatever Totti saw, whatever Totti wanted to do.
A great side, I felt. I was in Rome at the time, and I would regularly go and see that team. The alternative was Delia Rossi's Lazio with Tommaso Rocchi up front. Not all that great. But that team with David Pizarro in front of the defence.
What a player.
Mexes and Kivu, centre-back.
Mexes, of course, scored a goal of the season that season.
Was that season away at Milan?
The stupid overhead.
The crazy thing from on the edge of the area on the left.
Whatever that was. Yeah.
Right.
Amantino Mancini, remember the stepovers at Lyon?
Lyon, yeah.
He also pulled off one of the trademark, I don't know if it was against Lyon, I don't know if it was that season, but... For me, one of the Totti trademarks, which there are many, is when he retreats deep, usually in a wide area, gets the ball, and he just pings it.
Around the corner.
He does it in this game, this like no-look outside of the boot pass. I don't even remember who scored off it. I don't. But you have no idea how he does it, how quickly his brain registers what's going on and he hits that pass, because it's not a blind pass.
No.
What would you call the other trademark? Because when you're talking about vision, I mean, his ability to use his a backheel pass as well to catch defenses.
I mean, there's a fantastic compilation on YouTube. She's about 15 minutes long of just passes like that, that Totti does. And then, of course, Cucchiaio, James.
Yeah, the spoon.
Yeah.
But it's interesting when Totti was playing false nine, because I had this conversation with Capello, and I had it with Capello the year he left Real Madrid, and then he kept insisting on this about how Totti, he's like, when he was younger, obviously when he had him at Roma, he's like, well, I had Batistuta and Montella, so obviously he had to play somewhere else. But he's like, Totti should only play as a center forward now, because Totti always hits the target. And this is before data and analytics and stuff, and it's true. He was one of the very best strikers of the ball in terms of getting the ball on target. And he laid out this parallel with Cristiano. Now, obviously, there's very many differences. Cristiano's aerial ability, Cristiano's even now is probably more athletic than like young Totti. But their ability to strike the ball and to strike the ball cleanly and make it go where they want, no matter the position, they almost always really, you know, it's never an easy save and it's almost always on target.
Francesco Totti then, at the peak of his game and Roma romping away in Serie A. However, in February of 2006, Francesco fractures his leg against Empoli. Roma's run continues on remarkably well, actually, but the big question now for Francesco is he going to make it back for the big tournament coming up that summer, the World Cup in Germany? Another chance for Francesco to stamp his name on an international tournament, to earn that international recognition that his career, to be fair, had so far not elicited. What would happen? Well, that's something we're going to be looking at in part two of our big Totally Totti show, when we'll also be discussing why Gabriele, of all of his achievements, what he did from the mid-noughties, from that World Cup onwards, in his 30s, with Roma in decline, with a metal plate in his leg, is almost the most impressive thing of all. Join us again then when we return in the next Golazzo for part two of the Totti story. For now, many thanks to Gabriele and James, and from all of us here, it's arrivederci. Campionato di
calcio italiano. You've been listening to Golazzo, the Totally Italian Football Show. It's a Muddy Knees Media production, and for sales and advertising, please email sales@muddyneesmedia.com. Check out our other football shows on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Audioboom, and everywhere else you get your audio on demand.
Join Ruby Walsh, Paddy Power, Tom Nugent, and a whole host of great guests each week on Paddy Power's new racing podcast, From the Horse's Mouth. Tune in for analysis, interviews, and a bit of crack from the greatest trio since the Bee Gees. Ha, 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 ha. From the Horse's Mouth. From the Horse's Mouth. Ha, ha, yeah.
Muddy Knees Media.